I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Missouri voters just approved the medical use of marijuana. This was welcome news for those who suffer from cancer, glaucoma, and epilepsy, just a few of the conditions for which cannabis is reported to help. But for doctors who have never prescribed it, there are a slew of questions around when to turn to medical marijuana, how much to prescribe, and whether to use it at all. Today we'll explore those gray areas. Then, when it comes to the history of Thanksgiving, some are calling for educators to present a broader and truer picture of the holiday. We'll ask what's in their lesson plans when explaining a holiday that some see as a day of mourning. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Missouri voters have made medical marijuana a legal option for patients with very specific conditions, but some doctors have lots of questions about how to proceed here. Many don't really understand how medical marijuana will affect patients, especially those taking other prescription drugs. And will patients know exactly what they're getting? A Washington University study from last year found that just 9% of medical schools teach about medical marijuana, and 90% of med school graduates say they aren't ready to help patients use it. With us to help sort all this out is Dr. Darren D'Agostino. He's Executive Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine and Vice President for Health Affairs with the Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences. Doctor, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
So is the medical profession, you know, generally speaking here, ready to deal with legalized medical marijuana, or do we have a road to travel yet?
Oh, I think we definitely have a road to travel. We have a long way to go, but we are moving in a direction that I think is going to be important for patients as we move forward.
What are your students asking, or are they asking you questions about all this?
We do have students that are asking questions about what this means to their practice and what's going to happen in the future. Long story short, there's not a lot of information going out to medical students because of the controversy associated with medical marijuana.
Meaning it's been illegal and it's difficult to teach something that's considered illegal?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is because of the way marijuana is scheduled with the FDA, it's very difficult to have extensive research done. And in fact, there are some other obstacles based on medical marijuana that could be used in research, where it has to come from, the different agencies that have to give permission for this. And what that's done is really limited a lot of the research that could be done to prove its efficacy as well as to identify the side effects, the complications, and the problems that could come.
Is that going to change now that so many states have legalized medical marijuana? Surely the FDA is going to step in here, or am I wrong?
Well, I don't know if you're wrong, but we haven't seen that happen yet. So currently we have, after this past election, 33 different states that are that have the ability to use marijuana with patients, and some of those states have recreational use as well. What we have not seen is a federal change in the scheduling of the drug, and it is still illegal at a federal level. And what that means is we have a conflict. Physicians really can't prescribe medical marijuana. They can make a recommendation. And then from there, the states that have legalized it allow for the distribution, which is overseen by a state agency.
So patients aren't going to be getting traditional prescriptions, a piece of paper in their hand to take down the street to get a fill of medical marijuana.
That is correct. In fact, if a prescription is written, one of the things that that many states mandate is that that prescription essentially get thrown out. It cannot be used to fill a marijuana request.
You know, maybe this is a good time to pause and just ask, how did we get here? Why are we at this point today?
I think that is a great question. We have to look at where we've been in order to know where we're going. You know, about 1,000 years ago, marijuana was used in China, India, Egypt for medicinal purposes. And
we're just catching up now.
Well, the thing is there weren't a lot of studies. But the things that you read about in some of that history is the analgesic effects and the anticonvulsant effects. And in fact, those are the places where many of the patients that are using medical marijuana now are focused. In the 1830s, it was first brought to Europe, and then from there in the 1850s is the first time we really saw it here in the United States. Interestingly, from the 1850s to about the 1890s, all right, we saw its use, and then after that it started to go away, and that was because of the rise of a different analgesic, and those were the opiate compounds.
Mm-hmm.
And almost universally, physicians had a better effect for the treatment of ailments, particularly pain, using an opiate. And so we didn't see much use of medical marijuana. It really wasn't until the 1960s when the recreational use started to come back in. And then from there, the understanding that people that had certain conditions, particularly with nausea and vomiting, were able to tolerate their medications if they smoked marijuana. And that was really the rise and the push of using this for medicinal reasons.
Well, I'm wondering how you and other doctors feel about this notion that medical marijuana is being made available not at the behest of the federal government or the FDA, but by popular will of the people. People are saying, hey, docs, we want you guys to be open to this particular treatment. Is that sort of not the way it's supposed to work? Is there some resentment here at the way this thing has rolled out?
Well, I can't speak for all physicians,
sure.
But what I can do is tell you that this is probably the main issue that's occurring or at least being discussed at medical societies and among physicians. One of the big challenges here is this is, if not the only medicine, one of the only medicines that has been legislated into use prior to the understanding of safety and efficacy. Now, there is some evidence out there that it's a fairly safe medicine to take, but it's fairly safe in terms of the comparison to other drugs, which are in the same schedule that the FDA has it. And that may not be fair because there could be other side effects or challenges that medical marijuana has that just haven't been studied yet. Again, as we talked about, the federal government classifies this as a Schedule I drug. So mm-hmm. It is highly restrictive and, in fact, illegal at a federal level. So for us to be able to do research to understand the complexities of the drug, it's limited. And that's where we have a problem. The legislation is allowing the use of something that we don't have a full profile of efficacy and side effects.
Doctors don't really understand what this thing is essentially what you're saying.
Well, I think the doctors have, for the evidence that's available, the ability to look at that evidence that is available and make a decision. What we don't have is a certifying body that is giving us the opportunity to ensure the safety and the knowledge base. In other words, there might not be enough for us to make informed decisions with our patients.
And as a result, a lot of doctors are going to say, I don't prescribe or I don't offer medical marijuana cards that will allow you to go down the street and get a prescription filled.
I think that is exactly what's going to happen here in our state as well as in other states. We've seen that happen. And that's really not much different than what's going on with opiates. In fact, when a doctor is uncomfortable prescribing it, we generally try not to in the best interest of the patient. Now, the question is whether you're uncomfortable because of the legal issues surrounding it or you're uncomfortable because it's not the right medicine. And that is something that physicians are battling with all the time. We have to make choices of what's the right treatment, the right medication for a patient with a specific issue. And when we don't have enough information to be able to drive that decision, it becomes uncomfortable. And I think medical marijuana is walking into that position in our pharmacopoeia.
So how are doctors taught to handle these situations where a patient is saying, I want this particular drug, in this case, medical marijuana, and a doctor is saying, I'm not comfortable giving it to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think physicians, we are all trained to create partnerships with our patients. And it is critical that communication be the front and center of that relationship. Conversations about the benefits and risks of any medication, treatment, surgery we recommend is critical. It's absolutely critical. One of the things that is known is that for just about everything that medical marijuana can treat, we have other medications that have been proven through study and through research to be more efficacious. Now, that doesn't mean that they're the only medicines that should be used. What it does mean is that we have to find alternatives, or we have to come to a conclusion that medical marijuana is the best option. We all know, and as a physician, I've heard this a number of times from my patients and from others, that medical marijuana has helped them in certain cases, particularly nausea, vomiting due to chemotherapeutic agents or to erosive conditions like esophagitis or gastritis. There are these conditions that medical marijuana does seem to help. It has some evidence that it's going to help, and there is some research that proves it. But there are many, many other conditions that it's being used for that we're unsure about. For instance, seizure disorder. Medical marijuana, because it's not regulated by the FDA and because we don't have enough research, we don't know the dosing of the different components of the medical marijuana that's being used to treat it.
The dosing, what does that mean?
So the two main ingredients that we look at are THC and CBD, right? So tetrahydrocannabinol, and the other is cannabidiol. All right. So the CBD portion of that seems to have a very good effect on seizures. But if you're walking into a dispensary and there isn't any regulation on the growth of those plants that are going to be either smoked or ingested or whatever the delivery system is, you may not be getting the right dose to control the seizures. And so how do we know that what we're giving or recommending to the patient is going to have the effect? Now, that's only one example, and there are many examples, many of it is anecdotal, of people that do well, and we do control seizure disorders with that. But without the evidence, without the true studies to prove one way or the other, physicians are in an uncomfortable position prescribing this because we just don't know. We don't have enough confidence in the structure.
We're talking about how doctors across Missouri are going to handle the whole idea of medical marijuana going forward in the wake of the vote earlier on this month that legalized medical marijuana going forward. I'm visiting with Dr. Darren D'Agostino, who's Executive Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine and Vice President for Health Affairs with the Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences. If you want to join our conversation, our number here is 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So bottom line is there's a lot of doctors who are really uncomfortable with what's happening here right in front of their eyes.
I think there are, and I think there are doctors who are comfortable with it because they've read the existing literature and they're making recommendations. We do know that if we look at death rates due to overdose, it's very simple to see or very straightforward that when we deal with opiates, there is an increasing number of deaths due to overdose. But when we're dealing with medical marijuana, we don't see that. As a matter of fact, it's been flat for the last 15 years. So we don't see an increase with the use and even with the legalization in other states. That creates a perception of safety. But in reality, there are other things we have to be concerned about. There is evidence that there could be liver and kidney damage from chronic use. We see COPD increasing in people who are chronic users.
What is COPD?
COPD is a pulmonary disease. It's a lung disease that people get from smoking. And you can actually, it's very bad in smokers for cigarettes and tobacco. But we actually see an increase also in medical marijuana use when it's inhaled.
Well, you're taking the words out of my mouth because I was going to ask you next, is there any evidence that smoking marijuana can cause harm? And you're suggesting that the answer to that question is yes.
There are conditions that can be worsened, and there are outcomes from just using the medications that can be there. But again, the complete look or the evidence that's been produced is not as widespread as many people think. And there is a perception that we have truly legalized the medication, but that's really only at an individual state level. Again, at the federal level, we haven't legalized it. The FDA has not reclassified it as less than a Schedule I med. And those create some concerns in terms of how we are going to use those medications.
Well, given the fact that now more than 30 states have legalized medical marijuana, would it be your view that the FDA is now incumbent on that agency to begin studying exactly what marijuana does to people?
I believe that if we reschedule it at a federal level, we are going to see a very large body of evidence come out that's going to support the use of medical marijuana in certain conditions, and it's going to give us a profile of side effects and complications that's going to help us better understand where it should be used. Interestingly, this is not the first time we see plants giving us medications. As a matter of fact, we used to say, and I still teach medical students this, if we found aspirin today out of the bark of a willow tree, it probably wouldn't make it through the FDA because of all the things that it could cause. Mm-hmm. We studied it. We created an understanding around it, and we now know how to use it. And we're seeing the way we change the way we give it to people based on that side effect profile, based on the complexities and complications that you can get from it. We just don't have that information yet. So my belief is the FDA should be listening to what the physicians are asking for, and that is give us the ability to be able to study this so that we can make a better decision for our patients.
So what's happened, doctor, in other states that have legalized medical marijuana? I mean, has there been, what, a small minority of doctors who are willing to hand out the medical marijuana cards, and they've seen their business skyrocket and lots of other doctors have held back? Is that sort of what I'd imagine is happening here?
Well, I think one of the things in reading mostly the media about other states' actions, I'm a little bit deeper into it here in Missouri and understanding where these decisions have developed from. But a lot of this comes out of the needs of the patient. When we have patients who are suffering and they've been through traditional plans of medicines and traditional regimens and they're not getting relief, physicians want to do the best for their patients. They always do. That's what we're trained to do. It's what we believe. And in some cases, it governs most of what we do. What we need to understand here, though, is that this legalization at a state level is in response to those things I just discussed. It's not a response to the evidence of the efficacy and the safety profile of the medicine. And that creates the challenges. So I think what's been happening is when physicians are backed into a corner, and if I had a patient like this, I would consider, now that this is legal here, using something that could help fix some of that suffering. Mm-hmm. And those are the complexities that we have to deal with. And I believe most of this was driven out of trying to do good for patients.
And so would you expect then that there would be a small minority of doctors who say, okay, I'm going to hand out the cards, and most other doctors will hold back for a while?
Well, I think we're going to see the physicians who are comfortable writing for a recommendation for this medication. Those are going to be the doctors that probably have a higher number of patients in their patient panel that have these conditions. Mm-hmm. Now, here in our state, we have a number of different conditions that we can treat with this medication now. And some of them have evidence, some of them don't, or I should say have limited evidence. We have to really take every patient one by one to know what the step is that is going to be right for them.
Hmm. How about patients suffering from mental illness? That's also an area that's a little bit cloudy when it comes to use of marijuana of any kind, if I understand right.
Yeah, and this is actually one of the special circumstances that I believe physicians really need to understand before giving a recommendation for this medication. One of the things that's going to be very, very important to keep in mind is that there is a system within our body called the endocannabinoid system. So our bodies actually make these medicines. And the phytocannabinoids, which is really what marijuana is, it's a plant-derived cannabinoid that will work within our system, affects many, many things throughout the body. We actually teach that in medical school because it's an important system. And this is where the connection to medical marijuana comes into the curriculum in medical schools that are teaching this. But what's important about this is that there are effects that this system, when changed, can be detrimental. And if there is underlying psychiatric illness, we may actually trigger some events that could be a problem, and that was not an intent. So for physicians that are going to be recommending this to their patients, they are going to need to know what those contributing factors to possible side effects are and have to, again, partner with their patients before they make the decision.
How doctors are approaching medical marijuana use in Missouri, that's our topic here. Our guest again, Dr. Darren D'Agostino. Let's go to some phone calls here. Tom from Olathe. Tom, you're on Up to Date.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, have they any evidence that marijuana causes genetic issues? Like maybe we've had quite an increase in ADHD in children, and most of the people in the 60s and 70s at least experimented with it. So I'm just curious whether there's any evidence of that.
What's the link between medical marijuana helping kids with attention deficit disorder, doctor?
Well, so far, the research that I've reviewed, I don't see that there are genetic changes or alterations that are occurring. There has been a lot of research done on that rise of ADHD and ADD and the contributing factors to that. I think it would be very difficult to link a single element to that.
Right.
Agreed that the timing of this, and with the future population growing out of people that potentially have experimented recreationally with this, may be a coincidence and not necessarily a causation.
I'm wondering how the Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences, which you represent here today, doctor, what are you guys recommending here? Are you saying it's up to each individual graduate to wrestle with this decision, or are you actually recommending that doctors should hesitate before prescribing anything close to medical marijuana?
So we're taking the approach that we take with everything we teach. All right. We're giving our medical students a very, very strong foundation to be able to use evidence to make decisions. We are recommending that they understand what the side effects and what the benefits are of every medication that we prescribe. Mm-hmm. We are teaching, and I subscribe to this as well, that every medication a physician prescribes is actually a poison. And we need to understand what happens when we give that medication to a patient. What we're also doing is teaching them about the systems within the body that something like medical marijuana could influence. And certainly now that it's legal in this state, I think we're going to see the curriculum in all of the medical schools start to increase in terms of the type and amount of education around this medication. We also have to understand the legal consequences and the opportunities for research, and that is another thing that we are hoping that our medical students will contribute to as they move through their medical careers.
Right.
Is research in this area.
You know, I've read that it'll probably be, you know, something like a year before the state health department in Missouri has finished writing rules and Missourians can walk into a dispensary and buy medical marijuana. Does that sound about right to you, doctor?
Yeah, there are some. The amendment 2 that passed did actually put some timelines into when patients can petition to be registered and when dispensaries can as well. I think we're going to see probably about 2 years is a rough estimate before we're going to see the dispensaries be able to actually give medication out. It's about 250 days.
Yeah.
From December 6th.
Okay, that's Dr. Darren D'Agostino, again, Executive Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine. He's with the Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences. Thanks for the good rundown. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the real history of Thanksgiving and how teachers are handling it in the classroom these days. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we learned about how climate change is already altering the tall grass prairies of Kansas. You can hear about those changes and listen to other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Well, it's been almost 400 years since the settlers at Plymouth had a harvest celebration that eventually became the national holiday of Thanksgiving. In classrooms, the event was often pictured as two cultures coming together for a feast after the, quote, Indians helped the pilgrims plant native crops and find game that would stave off starvation in the coming winter. In recent years, Native Americans and historians are pushing for a more complete picture with a broader context that shows the impact of European colonization on the original occupants of this land. These days, our schools offering a more complete picture of the holiday that some Native people see as a day of mourning? Helping us answer that question today are Dr. Jennifer Kephart. She's Assistant Superintendent for Elementary Education in the Lee Summit School District. Jennifer, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And from the studios of Kansas Public Radio, we have Eric Anderson, who's a professor and chair of the Indigenous and American Indian Studies Department at Haskell Indian Nations University. Eric, welcome back. Nice to have you again.
Great to be here with you, Steve.
Well, Eric, first off, the details of that feast from 1621, you know, mostly came from the writings of European men who were members of the colony. You know, were there any stories passed down from the Native Americans who were also there?
Well, there's, of course, a long tradition of Thanksgiving that exists in the Native American side of the story. As far as the specific feast of 1621, or the meeting of the two groups where food and other things were exchanged, it needs to be remembered that it was the Indians who brought the majority of the food, just as they had been assisting the so-called Pilgrims or Puritans there at Plymouth through that first hard year. And this is a tradition of American Indians to have a culture of exchange, and often food is the thing that brings people together. So they brought the food. I think the Puritans had in mind some other things. So of course they enjoyed the venison and the corn and squash and things that the local Indians, the Wampanoags, brought to them. But they also had designs on their land, and part of the meeting from their point of view was going to be some negotiation about getting access to more of that.
So, Eric, do the Native Americans tell stories about that 1621 meeting, or is there anything that's been passed down?
Well, I think there are definitely stories in the tradition of the Indians of Massachusetts. I think this is probably less of an important date for them than all of what surrounded it, because in a lot of ways, the Thanksgiving meal that we celebrate as coming out of that that first feast is within a context of a lot of really bad relationships between the Indians and the Puritans, you know, includes slavery, that includes warfare, and includes a lot of things that I think would overshadow the remembrance of that meal.
Well, given that, Dr. Gephart, at what grade level does the Lee Summit School District begin teaching the colonial period in this country and begin to tackle some of these issues?
Sure. So our third and fourth graders are the first that through state curriculum and through district curriculum that we really start focusing on that historical perspective of interactions between Native Americans and between European colonists.
Is it all rosy and sunshine, or is there something a little more realistic attached to it?
Sure, we do. We talk about the effects that the effects and the changes that the Europeans had on the Native Americans. And so we really do start start to look at both perspectives. And we have some of those conversations with our students about the perspectives of change, but also the perspectives of contributions and of impact and what contributions have the Native Americans brought to us currently, but also at that time as well.
And is this a change in the curriculum? If you went back 15 years, have things shifted when it comes to the teaching of Thanksgiving?
I think we have always, as a state, had a focus around that third, fourth grade level during that period of colonization where we have talked about Native Americans and their interactions. I think we have opened more to that perspective and that sensitivity and understanding of each of the different groups, and really that focus on thankfulness.
You know, are Native Americans ever invited to speak to the students?
Not that I know of. That doesn't mean that we don't have that.
Eric, how much value would there be in having Native Americans in the classroom informing students of their perspective on this whole thing?
Well, I think there could be great value in that. I often take students to area or regional schools to talk about Columbus, to talk about the impact of colonization, to talk about what it is to be a member of a tribal nation in the 21st century. And our students are generally greatly enthusiastic to do that, to tell their stories and, if you will, to set the record straight in some ways.
This notion of, to use your words, Eric, setting the record straight, are you seeing change in this country when it comes to doing exactly that?
Yes and no. As I learn about what schools are doing, for instance, as we're talking about at the primary school level, or even into you know, a high school setting, it seems like it's changed a great deal than when I went to school, for instance. There was still very much an entrenched notion of Columbus as discoverer, and a lot of the language surrounding colonial relationships flowed from that ethos.
Right.
I think that most people have kind of moved away from that, at least in the sense that it's pretty hard to you know, to square the idea of discovery when we all know people were already here. At the same time, I think there is still very much an entrenched notion that flows out of that thinking in terms of who Indians are, or even if they are here at all. I think the notion of the vanishing Indian is still one that resonates in a lot of people's minds. I think the misrepresentations of centuries of one-sided history and dime novels and Wild West shows and Western films, you know, still capture a lot of the popular thinking about American Indians. So it's a mixed bag.
We're talking this morning about how Thanksgiving is taught in public schools across Missouri and Kansas. If you want to join our conversation, our number here, 816-812-8, that's my cell phone number, 816-235-2888 is our number here in the studio, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Jennifer, how does the district approach Thanksgiving with earlier grades? You know, I'm thinking K through second grade.
So our big focus on kindergarten through second grade is really an understanding of Thanksgiving through literacy and really an understanding of family and thankfulness. So we have a lot of our schools that are doing different types of thankful and gratitude type activities during last week and this week, but all throughout the month as well. Mm-hmm. So it's an understanding of what those traditions are that families have, that we have as a school family, but also how we can be truly grateful for what we have and then tell people how we value them and what that looks like.
So a much more basic understanding of what Thanksgiving actually means then.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, Eric, if you want to step into the history here and go back to the 1600s, tell me if I'm wrong here, but in very broad terms, the initial meeting was regarded as this meeting between the people who were already here and folks coming from Europe. It had some positive aspects to it, but bad blood, bad relations only developed maybe a generation later. Am I seeing that right?
Yeah. So, you know, really when we think about Thanksgiving in a very broad sense,
yes.
We're having a kind of a built-in blind spot about even colonial history, because of course we have hundreds of years of colonization by the Spanish and the French preceding the arrival of the English, and the Coronado celebrated a Thanksgiving in 1541. It wasn't a meeting between native people, but it was a Thanksgiving for the Spanish survival in this place that was new to them.
I read that, and just to underscore your point, you're saying there were Thanksgivings before 1621, maybe even numerous Thanksgivings.
Absolutely, and on the Indian side of the equation, green corn festivals and all types of harvest festivals could, I think, be fairly called Thanksgiving celebrations that certainly predate the one we're thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Thanksgiving at Jamestown. So we've skewed our view of history, and that's happened for a number of reasons, because of the outcome of the Civil War, because of the training of historians in the majority of them in the Northeast at one point in time. So we've sort of automatically moved the needle to someplace else when we put Thanksgiving in our minds and in our history books as only beginning there in 1621 in Plymouth.
Right. And just to be clear, what happened a generation or so after 1621 that caused so much tumult here?
So, I think I'll go back just a little bit before that, because you already have a history of English sailors and traders and pirates predating the arrival and the settlement at Plymouth by the Puritans. So there's a history of very poor relations, with Indians being, essentially captured and sold into slavery. Squanto, who we associate with the Thanksgiving story, was one of those people, a Patuxet Indian, who survived the journey, forced journey over to England, and came back. And this is the first person that the Mayflower folks meet when they land. Hmm. And the first words they hear when they arrive are "hello" in English, because Squanto spoke English, and he was sort of their bridge to the local Indians, particularly the Wampanoags, who would end up being the principal caretakers, if you will, of those Puritan people.
And what happened to derive relations south here?
So, you kind of have this blip on the radar with Massasoit, the chief of the Wampanoags, shepherding this relationship for a variety of reasons. And then pretty soon, this is the English story all over again, from Roanoke to Jamestown to Plymouth. They arrive woefully unprepared. They are reliant at first upon the goodwill of the natives to survive. And then as more and more English, in this case, arrive, the balance of power shifts. They begin to make more and more demands for land, for resources. And so there's tension created within a couple of generations. You're right. It's devolved into, even sooner than a couple of generations, into hideous violence. The Pequot War in the 1630s,
right.
And then with Metacomet, the son of Massasoit, is the one the English call King Philip. And you have in the Pequot War and King Philip's War in the 1670s, two of the bloodiest conflicts in all of American history.
Right. And Dr. Jennifer Kephart, at what point do you get into some of this? Or is this, where is this addressed?
So this would be looking more at our middle school and through high school history.
Sure.
So absolutely.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And continuing to talk about that impact, continuing to talk about the impact on both sides.
Okay. Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Let's go to Elizabeth from Kansas City, Missouri. Elizabeth, you're on the air. It's nice to have you.
Hi, thank you. I am actually Native American, and I am just interested in kind of at what age, and hopefully it's in at least high school, but when is there education about what really happened with Native Americans in terms of, you look at genocide and how many were actually, basically the population was decimated as more and more white settlers went west. And, I guess just really the the reality of that? How is that communicated, or is that still kind of glossed over?
And let me go to and figure this out a little bit with Eric here. Some of this decimation was due to disease. Some of it was due to violence, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Disease was a major factor that I guess you could say paved the way for increased white settlement. The fact that Native people had no previous exposure to a lot of diseases that were common in, mm-hmm. in the so-called old world, that had a decisive effect. And there was plenty of warfare and violence to go around as well as expansion magnified.
Jennifer, how about all of that stuff?
So again, that would be looking at our high school curriculum mm-hmm. and having conversations of reality and what that really looked like and felt like at that time. And so that would be our high schoolers that would be exploring that sometimes in our U.S. history, but also through our advanced placement classes.
So it sounds like when high school students graduate in Lee Summit, they come out with something of a clearer-eyed view of what happened in those days than I did when I was a kid.
That would certainly be the hope. We want to be able to be sensitive and provide those multiple perspectives as well.
Elizabeth, thank you for the call. Let's go to Kathy from Peculiar, Missouri. Kathy, good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to hear comments on a thought. It seems like more and more we're looking at holidays with the perspective of many hundreds of years sometimes, and going back and saying, well, that didn't have a good outcome several decades later, so maybe we should feel guilty by celebrating this holiday, something that was created for maybe an excuse for people to have a moment. I don't know. And just as your guests have said, certainly most cultures have had some kind of a harvest Thanksgiving idea, a feast, a commemoration. Why can't we think of Thanksgiving as an event that was positive at the moment between two cultures that showcased the generosity of the Native Americans to these newcomers? Do we have to feel guilty for just having a day of thankfulness for the goodness
right.
of where we are? And
right, I get your question.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Let's go to Eric Anderson from Haskell Indian Nations University. Eric, how would you respond to Kathy here?
Yeah, so I appreciate what you're saying. I really do. I think there are some things within the context of that moment that we can point to and say that they were good. The generosity you mentioned, I think, is a great lens in through which to do that. I don't think we have to feel guilty. I don't think we have to give up our Thanksgiving. But what I'm suggesting is that we also don't give up our sense of history. Mm-hmm. We need to have Thanksgiving put in the context of what else was going on. It was a great moment in time, and I think it's one we can celebrate. Abraham Lincoln's the one who essentially proclaimed the holiday,
right?
You know, in the midst of great violence and division. I think we would do ourselves a disservice not to recognize that's when the holiday became a national holiday. But was he doing that in perhaps an attempt to heal a very divided and broken nation in the midst of a civil war? I think we have to have that context.
Yeah. Let's go to Richard from Overland Park. Richard, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about how teachers can teach about Thanksgiving.
I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you so much. I had a quick moment. Marlon Brando refused his Oscar, his Academy Award for The Godfather, and instead sent an Indian tribe representative, and pardon me for not remembering the Indian tribe, in his stead. And his social stand at the time was making a broad viewing audience aware that the information that they've received about Native Americans through, I think, in the conversation, dime store novels and movie portrayal, especially in this case, movie portrayal, was defamatory and truly incorrect. And I think that It's watershed moments like that that turn a culture, and I just wanted to get your comments. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Eric, what do you recall from that moment?
Oh, Sasheen Littlefeather. I believe she's Comanche. That's the woman that Marlon Brando sent to decline the Oscar. I do think it was something of a watershed moment. It got people thinking about the portrayals of Native people in film. She was roundly booed by others at the ceremony, and her speech essentially cut off by the producer of the show. So obviously there were a lot of entrenched feelings about Natives and some people who perhaps didn't have any qualms about those misrepresentations. But to the point, having a conversation, having a recognition of historical factors, historical outcomes, and historical legacies that we live with, I think are really important to get us to essentially a healthier place. And you know, going back to the previous caller, you know, that does not have to evoke feelings of guilt. You know, none of us sitting here today did those things in the past. But if we can't have a conversation about them, then I think we're not going to, you know, be able to move very, very, you know, very readily to a place of understanding.
Dr. Gephardt, I'm wondering how students in Lee Summit usually respond to the uglier parts of our history. What kind of reactions do you get?
Well, I think, again, that primarily happens on that end, on our high schools. And so it is the understanding and starting to understand different perspectives, not just Native Americans, but in different cultures as well. So what does that look like? And sometimes that's difficult for students as they go through and see and hear things that they may have seen and heard differently, just as we were speaking of in our current culture.
Yeah. I'm wondering, in Lee Summit, who determines what gets taught about Thanksgiving in the schools? How's that get decided?
So we have state curriculum, and our state curriculum then goes through district curriculum, and district curriculum is written by teachers and by our curriculum director. And then teachers in their classrooms have activities and engagement that really involves students in that learning.
And that sort of helps. That's how it works.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. Interesting conversation. Sorry I couldn't get to all the phone calls here. I want to thank Eric Anderson, who joined us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio. He's a professor and chair of the Indigenous and American Indian Studies Department at Haskell Indian Nations University. Eric, always appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Hey, thank you, Steve. Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. And Dr. Jennifer Gephardt is Assistant Superintendent for Elementary Education in the Lee Summit School District. Jennifer, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you. And you can hear previous episodes of the program at kcur.org/up-to-date. That includes my conversation yesterday with writer David Gran about a terrifying and deadly journey across Antarctica. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.